The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this week's Century, remembering Ernie Drucker. Ernest Drucker, PhD, was a brilliant man. He was also a good friend and colleague. Ernie was professor emeritus in the Department of Family and Social Medicine at the Montefiore Medical Center, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and a senior research associate and scholar in residence at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. For decades, Ernie conducted research on AIDS, drug policy, and prisons, and was active in public health and human rights efforts in the U.S. and around the world. He was the author of over 100 peer-reviewed scientific articles, texts, and book chapters. Ernie was founding associate editor of the International Journal of Drug Policy, founder and editor-in-chief, along with John Booth Davies, of Addiction Research and Theory, and the founding editor-in-chief of Harm Reduction Journal. His book, A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America, was published by The New Press in September of 2011. Ernie was a founder of the International Harm Reduction Association and a founder and chairman of the board of directors of Doctors of the World USA. Ernie was also a jazz aficionado and a Mets fan. He had a loving family and more friends than you could ever count. Born in 1940, Ernest Drucker passed away on January 26, 2025. It is one of my life's regrets that I never managed to record an interview with Ernie, but there are a few recordings of him speaking out there, and we're going to hear some of that today. First, from April 24th, 2017, here's Ernie at NYU's Weisberg Forum for Discourse in the Public Square on Criminal Justice Reform.
I worked at Rikers Island 25 years ago because my hospital, Montefiore in the Bronx, had a contract for over 20 years to provide health services at Rikers Island when it was a lot smaller, but it grew to its present size as a number of things with drugs and AIDS happened in the Bronx. But that was my graduate education in criminal justice, and I ran shrieking from it, frankly, and got more involved with AIDS because AIDS had come along at the same time, and that was something we could actually do something about, where our science made a difference, where we could, you know, we did a pretty good job on AIDS, which was heavily involved in the drug injecting issue, the way in which overdose is now. And you keep seeing these manifestations of the poor quality of our drug policies in this country that led to mass incarceration, that have led to this overdose epidemic we have now, 55,000 deaths last year. At the height of the crack epidemic, it was about 7,000, give you a sense of scale. And the new profile of overdoses is people who get involved in it through pain medication, which they become addicted to, and then suddenly there's a black market that comes to meet them. Heroin market all over the United States now, especially in New England and in the American South. So, you know, for a behavioral scientist, epidemiologist I am, what are your tools to deal with this? Because the facts of it don't really persuade people, because there's an attachment to this system of punishment. Surveys of punitiveness in America still continue to give very, very unpleasant ratings about attitudes, about the death penalty, about punishment. But if you look at those results and the populations they relate to carefully, what you see is the history of racism in our criminal justice policy. So many of you may know my friend and colleague's book, New Jim Crow, by Michelle Alexander. I have the fortune of having given her the number that she needed to do this, which was there were as many slaves at the beginning of the Civil War in 1860 as there are African-American men in the criminal justice system now, jail, prison, and the parole and probation, probably even more than that. So you get a sense of the scale of and people have some understanding that slavery was a terrible thing for us to have done, and we still haven't made reparations shown remorse about it in this society. And that's a big deal, because the victims of it are still there. And there's another movie called The 13th, which you may have seen, which relates to the 13th Amendment that Lincoln signed a week or two before he was assassinated, to free the slaves. And it has in it this clause that the 13th Amendment, that except for convicted criminals, where there's no obligation to, because it begins bondage and what's the exact wording? Does anyone have it? Bondage and slavery and involuntary servitude, except, and immediately goes to the except for criminals who've been duly due process and convicted, that it was okay to exempt them from the end of slavery. And it's amazing that that was explicit in 1865 because it disappeared from sight. I didn't hear anything about it myself. Maybe the lawyers here had been looking at the wording of these amendments. I hadn't. But it turns out to be the backbone of the system, because everything we see about the way the prison system has evolved with non-white people is very consistent with the rule of slavery. Impunity, absolute unaccountability to do anything. And it was driven by the economic structure that slavery had in American society. That hasn't been acknowledged, that hasn't been compensated. Instead, you have the prison system, which is another jobs program based on the punishment of black people in America. And that has to be faced up to squarely. I don't see a way out of this without doing that, because if the kinds of treatment that takes place in jails and prisons was happening to white people in this country, there'd be a different story about it. There'd be a different accountability about it. We all know that. And so to face this issue, and that's what's so great about this film, The 13th, Eva DuVernay, who made it, is it focuses very clearly on those issues, and it provides the groundwork for each piece of it. Glenn Martin is about to do a leadership program that'll be in the communities that have so many former prisoners in them. For New York City, for example, 6 communities in New York provide 85% of all the prisoners in the state prison system in New York. And those communities, for every person in prison, from every person who's in prison from those communities, the million-dollar blocks that Glenn mentioned, there are 5 or 6 who have been in prison, maybe more than that, actually. And they live in the communities they came from, because where else would they go? And those communities need to be transformed into places that can heal the wounds of the system we've created for punishment, and educate people, the kids in those communities that are at very high risk. The child of a prisoner now, born now, African-American male prisoner in the United States, close to 40% lifetime risk of imprisonment in the population. And if you take away the high school diploma, look, it gets up to 80%. Very, very, very high rates pulled out of these communities. And in New York, we know which those communities are. And they have to be healed, those communities. They have to have programs, not only for the drug problems that continue to rave, because we don't really do justice to drug treatment. We have effective treatments now for every one of the addictive drugs, actually. And they involve using other drugs called medication-assisted treatment. It turns out that cannabis, marijuana, is one of the most effective agents for treating addictions, not alcohol, cocaine, heroin, would you believe. And we have a phenomenon that the states that have medical marijuana have 30 to 40% lower rates of overdose from opiates, because the cannabis that's out there for people to use modulates the risks of using opiate-based painkillers. Finally, I think that if we can begin to recognize the value of the people who are coming out of prison, and the violent, many of whom are going to have committed violent offenses, recognize that those people did something crazy, terrible when they were 16, 18, 20 years old, for the most part, it's that kind, and they served 30 years in prison and come out of that often the strongest people. If it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. And Glenn's leadership group has the potential, over 200 trained people now, to go back to those communities and take a leadership role in the areas that have been abandoned by the rest of the community, the education of these populations, job programs, and psychotherapy and drug treatment. So they're very, very straightforward things to be done, but they got to be done. You can't just talk about them. And they cost incredibly less than the jail and the prison. Glenn's figure of over $200,000 a year per bed in Rikers Island, you know, to keep people in that torturous situation, to recognize that this is Torture Island at this point. Call it what it is, stop being polite about it. Because the criminalization and the demonization of the criminals, the criminalized, especially black man in this society, the Willie Horton syndrome, we have to confront that. And it's going to be a job. I'm part of a project in the American South now because we're focusing on that because they have the worst rates of every problem, AIDS, drugs, overdose deaths, and incarceration. They go together. We call it the Southern Syndemic. And the idea here is to begin to simultaneously take on those issues. But it's not going to happen out of the federal government, this one we have now. It's not going to happen out of most southern state governments. It's going to happen from the people themselves and the public health and medical programs. We've created a collaboration of the historically black medical schools and colleges in the South and all the public health schools in the South. And we're going to begin to create a regional program, which will hopefully leap past the state level where you can't get anything done in the South. They're busy fighting about the Confederate flag. But the professions that are involved, the health professions, the public health professions, the mental health professions, social work, have a lot to offer. And if we work together and let Bill Gates give us money the way he gives it outside the country, and we can take care of, you know how many people there are in the South? 80 million. It's not a small population. And we could address that population and make substantial gains in their life expectancy and the quality of their life and look after their children. And we'd see the result. If you monitor these things as you go along, if you set the, as an epidemiologist, if you set in place the measures to keep track of the important variables, how long children live, childhood events, you know, these trauma measures, trauma-informed discourse is the new buzzword in most social service training. So if we just begin to do our jobs professionally, as we've done in medicine, see, medicine, because it's in the laboratory and has wonder drugs, can get away with this. In the behavioral and social sciences and public health, it's much harder. You have to have a public will to do it. But I think there's room there to take the skills that we do have and the educational people that are there, the leadership people, and begin to make that our job and do it. We're going to have to do it outside of government. Thank you.
That was Professor Ernest Drucker, Ph.D., speaking April 24th, 2017 at NYU's Weisberg Forum for Discourse in the Public Square, the topic of criminal justice reform. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, we're remembering a good friend, colleague, and a longtime leader in harm reduction and drug policy reform, Ernie Drucker. On January 13, 2016, Ernie gave a talk at the Clinton School of Public Service at the University of Arkansas entitled From Punishment to Public Health, Transforming Global Drug Policies and Supporting Human Rights. Let's hear part of that.
An important philosophical point here. Niels Christie, who passed away last year, a sociologist from Norway, one of my inspirations and mentors, wrote a book called Limits to Pain, which is available on the internet for free. It's about 80 pages long. And he makes a very important point, and that is imposing punishment within the law means inflicting pain and doing so deliberately. And when the state undertakes to do that, it's in a moral quandary, is the point he tries to make. And reconciling this with the effects that it has on human behavior and shaping morality is an issue, the intentional infliction of pain. So he says we have to confront this reality and find alternatives to punishment because, you know, all of us who have raised children know that punishment is one of the things you can do. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's not the only thing you can do. But with a certain category of violations of custom, thou shalt be punished. And that's ancient lore, you know. I wouldn't call it wisdom, but it's certainly ancient. There's nothing new under the sun in crime and punishment. in terms of what people think, what they do, what it means. Nobody wants to have their, you know, their daughter kidnapped. Nobody wants to have their car stolen. Nobody wants to be assaulted and left to die in their blood in the street. So there's natural law is the term that's used for these things. And everyone agrees you want to have an orderly society which provides security to people. And the trouble is that gets altered by the state taking on this role of a large-scale punisher. And one of the forms that takes one of the most pernicious is forced drug treatment. All over the world, many nation institutions force drug users into treatment, which is indistinguishable from brutal punishment, even torture. Sorry. So here are some examples of forced drug treatment around the world. This is in Sierra Leone in West Africa. These are the conditions where if you have, which is in all the, you know, drug addiction as a disease is listed in all the international catalogs of disease, the international classifications of disease. The UN upholds that it's a health problem, addiction. And yet this is the approach to treating it in many countries and calling it treatment. You know, military oversight, large crowds made of men especially, made to do slave labor. Children in isolation who are still minors in detention camps. Guys doing military-style exercise as part of their rehabilitation. So it's to crush people who do this, to give them a message that they're going to be suffered and maybe killed if they don't stop. And there are people who think that's just fine because we won't tolerate having these people use drugs. And they'll go out and have a martini over it. Here's a policewoman in China in a forced labor camp. And it's a real 21st century version of a forced labor camp. But you know, they had to put nets outside the factories to keep people from committing suicide. Now, the other thing is death penalty for drug offenses. There are about 25 nations which still have death penalties for different drug offenses. On a report from Harm Reduction International, a group that's been looking at drug policies for a long time, I'm part of. And here are the high rollers: China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore. Between them have about 1,000 executions every year. The Chinese, there's no way to verify their numbers, but they're higher than that. But these are cases for small amounts of drugs. Let me show you one. There's no time to read this. But look, in one, Malaysia alone, a large country, marijuana, hashish, hemp, 77 executions for carrying marijuana across the border. If you go into Singapore, you'll see a line. If you cross this line, there's a garbage can where you can leave anything, any contraband behind. But if you don't, they promise you inside they'll kill you. Makes an impression. In Kuwait, people are hanged for drug offense. Yeah, it's just a steady drumbeat of the total impunity in terms of human rights declarations of the United Nations, rule of law, due process. None of it applies to these people, all in the name of treating the evil of drug addiction. I knew an attorney in the Bay Area once who used to defend drug dealers and win. And how can you do that? He said, well, what I show is that the things that the officials did to get these drug dealers into prosecution, things that the deceit they did, the things they set up, because the guys were drug dealers, it was true, but the things they did were far worse than what the drug dealers did, and I could convince a jury of that when you open up the human rights dimension of it and following due process. So human rights abuses in the name of drug control are distressingly common. That's a takeaway message. Now, decarceration, a new word. I thought I made it up, actually. You know, you have all this mass incarceration, and how do you get rid of it? You have decarceration. You know, it's like denazification, you know, or detoxification, or decontamination, that kind of word. And it turned out I hadn't made it up, because I looked at Google, this 2.5 years ago, and there were 10,000 hits 2.5 years ago. And among those were 20 books with the title Decarceration. One of them was from 1971 by a guy named Richard Skull, who's a sociologist at UC San Diego. And he was writing about a particular period in history. And, well, let me go back to this later. He was writing about the period in the 1960s where we closed all the mental hospitals in the name of community care. We were going to replace these 19th century institutions that were full of abuse and neglect and a terrible, terrible example, and were not therapeutic by any means. We're going to replace those with loving community care. Great idea, but the money for it never materialized. It was associated with President Kennedy's community mental health bill, and then he was assassinated, and the Vietnam War was eating up the money, and it never happened. They closed all these hospitals, and the people became the homeless, okay, who were let out of these hospitals, because there were no homes they could come to. If you have those of us who've had a mentally ill relative with no ability to get serious support for where they can live when they're out of control, destroy a household. So it was an abandonment of responsibility on a huge scale. And I want to show you this. The rate of this, the rate per 100,000 of institutionalized people in mental hospitals was up here at about 450, and then began to drop off sharply when they began this policy in the late 50s and reached its asymptote by about 2000. So, and it's replaced, the dotted line is the prison population. The prison population takes their place. And many of the same people, of course, although there were more women in the mental hospitals than there were in the subsequent prison population. And this phenomenon of having almost a constant for an institutionalized population, and institutions that are ham-fisted and are brutal and are inadequate to a job of a rehabilitative function. Now, crime keeps falling around the country, and we still sustain this very large prison population. There were 2 million people behind bars in the United States 5 years ago, and there are still 2 million people behind bars, although everyone's saying that we're cutting this down, improving the drug laws, getting more people out on parole, all those sorts of things. Some of, they're all true in fact, but when you look at how much is going on, it's a drop in the bucket. So a public health paradigm for decarceration, meaning how do we not only get people out of prison, how do we get the prison out of people? Because imprisonment leaves very deep scars on the psyche of everyone involved in the situation. And you don't just turn it off on getting infected. There's a startling fact that in the 2 weeks after release from prison, the mortality rate, the death rate among people who come out of prison is 10 to 12 times as high as any other period for that same population. And what's particularly interesting about it is that it's true in the United States, it's true in Canada, it's true in Australia, it's true in Britain. Different countries, different policies, yet that same result. And suggests there's something about a stint in prison that damages you for reentry to society and makes you very vulnerable. The causes of those extra deaths are number one, drug overdose, number two, homicide, number three, suicide, number four, heart disease. So they're complicated reasons for dying, but the fact that they cluster at a point when people get out of prison, all they've wanted is to get out of prison. There's a terrible case in New York of Keith Brower, a kid who spent 3 years in Rikers because he couldn't make $500 bail. And when he got out, he finished his GED degree and he got good press and everybody was rooting for him, and he still hanged himself. You know, the fragility of a person who's been through that kind of trauma. Very, very striking. And we can't, going back to Niels Christie's point about the imposition of pain and suffering on people as a civic project, it's a bad mix. So, President Obama grants clemency to 95 people. Good. I have one on the list. The list is 9,000 at this moment. And Bill Bratton, who's the police commissioner in New York, formerly Los Angeles, he's worried about 6,000 federal prisoners getting released, he says, because it would be the largest one-time release of drug offenders who received harsh fences, and they're saying now they can not have to serve those. But they don't like to do do-overs in the criminal justice system, and it's not happening so quickly that people are getting out of prison. He says, well-intended, but would raise a lot of questions. He likening it to the Massachusetts, the mental hospitals. This deinstitutionalization before was evidence that the country was not prepared to deliver on its obligations to the most vulnerable populations and stand by them in an hour of need. It's considered un-American almost to do that at this point. Bibb Ratton, you know, the hard-boiled police commander, where were they all going? Where are the jobs? Where is the housing? Where is the ability to allow them not to become recidivists, to go back to prison? Because right now, two-thirds of them do go back to prison within 4 or 5 years. So you have this revolving door still. One-third of everybody in prison gets out every year. About half of those go back within 2 or 3 years, mostly on administrative failures of all the restrictions put on them by parole and probation. Another important group is the elderly in prison, okay? Very significant group of people serving long sentences, often for violent offenses in their youth, and with 30, 40, 50-year sentences, life sentences sometimes, and that population is growing. It's the fastest growing population in the prison is those over age 50. Report from Human Rights Watch, Old Behind Bars, the aging prison population in the United States, you see it, you know, every day, and there are calls for compassionate release and medical parole. I looked at one neighborhood in New York, Upper Manhattan, where Columbia is, in Washington Heights, 545 prisoners over the age of 55 had been released in the previous year back to that same community, and there was nothing there for them. Their suicide rate is way up there. In that, what's that famous movie? The Shawshank Rebellion, the old man in that. It's that story writ large. Recent report from Brennan Center, the reverse mass incarceration, the sense of, you know, put this thing behind us and get beyond it. So we're in the early days of that struggle, and I'm delighted that people at the Clinton School are interested in plumbing this a bit. Just a little reference here, and I'm going to stop, because I had spoken with Deanne, my friend here, about the drug use problems and drug injection and heroin, which is coming back big time because of opiates, and the role that has in AIDS. So you have an AIDS outbreak in Arkansas and another one in Indiana next door. And it's a replay of what we first learned before we knew about the way in which AIDS spread. And then, you know, the background of the conflict with the police and the police are the enforcers of the drug laws. There's better jobs for everyone to do, and the solutions to drug policy issues are there before us.
That was Professor Ernest Drucker, Ph.D., speaking January 13th, 2016, at the Clinton School of Public Service at the University of Arkansas. His talk was entitled, From Punishment to Public Health, Transforming Global Drug Policies and Supporting Human Rights. Ernie Drucker passed away at home on January 26th, 2025, at the age of 84. He will be greatly missed. Our condolences to his family and his many friends. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.